This is the Michigan State Colloquy Talk on Human Sexuality by Ira L. Reese. The title of the talk is Premarital Sex Codes, the Old and the New. The purpose of this colloquy on sexuality is in large part to see what higher education can contribute to your understanding, to the student's understanding of an ability to handle his own sexuality. I'm going to try and focus on this major purpose and utilize sociology as the discipline which may have something to offer beyond what is commonplace, beyond what is generally known about sexuality. I think the area of sex is particularly one in which people believe, because they've had some experience with it on some level, kissing, petting, coitus, that they have the answers to a great many questions. I think this is probably in many cases an erroneous position. For instance, in a related area such as divorce, people are quite convinced that the divorce rate for the last 30 years has been increasing in each year or each decade, when in reality practically nothing has changed in the divorce rate. The age at marriage, people believe, in the last few decades has continually dropped, when in actuality it stayed stable. The syphilis rate is thought of as running out of hand, when in actuality total cases of syphilis has gone down somewhat rather than up. I could go on in a variety of other areas where people feel that they're familiar and where the actual situation seems somewhat different than that. What most people tend to do, and this is where the sociologist comes in to try and add some perspective, most people tend to mythologize the past, build up all kinds of image of an ideal past situation, and to be myopic, to be nearsighted about the present and not really understand what the long range or the broad situation is. And because of these factors, to be somewhat anxious about the future. Now, I think the sociologist can help in clarifying past, present, and future on human sexuality, and that's what I'd like to do today. Let's start with the past. The mythologizing here goes somewhat along the lines of a belief that the entire past history was one long period of Puritanism, Victorianism, restraint, and similar types of outlooks on our past. Now, if we look at go back 200 years, say, and look at the church records in Massachusetts, look at the Groton Church in Groton, Massachusetts, which has been written up in several sources, and we find that next to the names of about one out of every three people, in this case a sample of about 200 names, that were married in the late 18th century is two small initials, C period, F period. And what the CF stands for is confessed fornication. Now, if one out of every three people married in this church confessed fornication, that is probably an underestimate of the percentage of people that had premarital intercourse, because typically the only one that would confess would be a pregnant female, and not every female that has premarital intercourse will be pregnant. Or we can go a century later. We can go almost 100 years ago to the presidential election in which Grover Cleveland was elected president, 1884. Now, during that campaign, Grover Cleveland ran on the Democratic ticket, and the Republicans found out what they asserted to be true and what was generally believed to be true, that Grover Cleveland had fathered an illegitimate child in 1874, 10 years before, with a woman by the name of Maria Halpin. And they used this in the campaign. They used it to ridicule what would be the case if you elected Grover Cleveland. For example, they made up a little ditty that went somewhat like this. Ma, ma, where's my pa? Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha. This was supposed to indicate to one that if you elected Grover, his illegitimate son would recite this little ditty. Now, the Democrats won, and they made up a little ditty on election night that went somewhat like this. Hurrah for Maria, hurrah for the kid. We voted for Grover, and we're damn glad we did. Now, that's 1884. That's almost a century ago. And there's an election in which a man was won the presidential election despite the charges of illegitimacy. And even at this day, when Rockefeller was married, people were concerned, or divorced rather, remarried, people were concerned that this divorce and remarriage would affect his political campaign. Adlai Stevenson's divorce, people said, hurt him and so on. But here, 100 years ago, you have an illegitimacy of this sort that didn't seem to stop the election of Grover Cleveland. Now, one might mention the fact that women didn't have the vote in 1884. Maybe things would have been different if they had the vote. But in any case, this is some sort of a testimony to the fact that our ancestors were not quite as tame, not quite as uninitiated into sex as we might think. Just one other example. Victoria Claflin, who was a left-wing feminist of the 1870s, almost again 100 years ago, she was a woman who was being fought in New York City by many people because of her radical ideas. One of the people that was fighting her, trying to block her feminist goals, was the Reverend Henry Ward Beecher, the brother of Catherine, who is well known for her writing. And at one point, Victoria Claflin had an affair with a Mr. Tilton. And it just happened that Mrs. Tilton was having an affair with the Reverend Henry Ward Beecher. And when Victoria discovered this, she notified Reverend Beecher and said, either you stop pushing to defeat my proposals, or I'll start publishing in my weekly newspaper the fact of your adultery with Mrs. Tilton. Well, the Reverend Beecher thought she was bluffing, and he didn't stop fighting her, and Victoria, true to her word, published in the headlines of her newspaper the fact that the Reverend Beecher was having an affair with Mrs. Tilton. This incidentally led to an adultery trial, since adultery is and was against the law in New York, and the result of the trial reflected some of the double standard of the age in that the Reverend Beecher was let off and Mrs. Tilton was convicted. And that is a pretty good trick. Now, I think the few examples I've given should do away with any imagery of our past as being a time in which two virgins, a male and a female, met, fell in love, married each other, learned about sex together. This probably was never a typical situation. In fact, one, I think, can say, looking at cross-cultural evidence and looking at historical evidence, that there's never been any society in the history of the world that has ever brought up even one generation where the majority of that generation of males were virginal at physical maturity, at, say, age 20. That really what the history of our past has been a history of most males being experienced premaritally in intercourse, except in a few societies where there's child marriage. But if they're allowed to be single till age 20, most males being experienced in premarital intercourse, and the difference in the societies being whether their partners would be a very narrow select group of women, lower class women, prostitutes, what have you, or whether their partners be a much wider group of females, such as girls living nearby and of the same social class and not a distinct group of professionals. And this is really the variation that occurs throughout history. The males are constantly seeking and obtaining sexual experience. The females are in some periods of time in some cultures generally willing, as willing as the males. In other periods of time in other cultures, only a restricted group of females, sometimes professionals, sometimes slaves, sometimes lower class, servicing the males. Now, this is amply demonstrated by what's the change that's happened in this country, which has literally been from one to the other of these two possible systems. The 19th century was a strong double standard system where a very limited, compared to today at least, group of females took care of these premarital sexual needs of the males. This group of females was heavily composed of prostitutes. In fact, the prostitute rate, the number of prostitutes per 100,000 men, was much, much higher in the 19th century than in the 20th century. In a very real sense, the prostitute has been run out of business to a great extent, not completely, but to a great extent by her amateur competitors in the 20th century. And this is the move in the 20th century, from the prostitute as the partner to the girl next door as the partner. So that the view of the 19th century as a period in which men and women entered marriage virginally is largely mythology. Now, this doesn't mean that one need reject that as an ideal. If that's the ideal that you want, fine. But if you think this ideal will ever be achieved, this is likely to be self-delusion, in that in the past it has never been achieved anywhere. And our own society is surely not tuned toward the achievement of two virginal mates marrying each other. But that doesn't speak for or against the moral worth of it. It speaks more or less to the practical likelihood of it occurring. Now, if we can move a little bit closer to the present situation, one of the common conceptions is that what's happened today is that the male and female have become almost identical, that there's almost full equality. And I think this is, again, a distortion of the real situation. There's no reason biologically that men and women could not become fully equal. At least we have societies in the world, such as the Trobian Islands, studied by Malinowski, indicate, where at about the age of 7 or 8, females start to have intercourse. About the age of 9 or 10, males start to have intercourse. And the females are just as eager and enjoy sexuality as much as the males. So there's very little difference in male-female sexuality in cultures of that sort, and a very good indication that females, if brought up this way, would enter into sexuality rather willingly. Now, I think the reason you probably will not get full equality between men and women in their sexuality in American society in the near future, and the reason you haven't achieved it in most societies, is not biological, but is sociological. I think the reason is that as long as the primary role of the two sexes differs, you're going to have their orientation to sex different. And by this I mean as long as the female is oriented primarily to marriage and the family, that's her primary goal. Now, she works in great numbers today, but I think it ought to be clear that there's been no increase in the past generation or two in almost any area in the percentage of women that are career women. The vast increase in working women is in very average non-career type jobs like sales clerks, stenographers, kindergarten teachers, things of this sort, not brain surgeons, lawyers, judges, so on. So So that, in fact, in college teaching, the field that I'm in, at the turn of the century, in 1900, 20% of the faculty, roughly 20%, was female. In 1969, it's still 20%. So that, don't mistake this vast increase in female work as any indication of equality between the sexes. The average salary of the female is far below that of the male. And the average kind of job she has is far below that of the male. So her primary goal is still marriage and the family. Her secondary goal, perhaps, is more occupation today than in the past. The male's primary goal is still, despite his greater participation and greater interest in marriage and the family, his primary goal is still occupational, still to earn a living. Given that as his primary goal, and given the female's primary goal is marriage, what you have here is a different orientation. The female wants to get involved in her primary task of marriage and raising a family quicker than the male does, so that she can't dilly-dally with sex quite as easily as he can. She can't take such a casual attitude towards sex as he can, or at least not as quite to the same extent, because she's constantly viewing a sexual relationship as something, well, that might help her achieve her primary goal. Whereas the male's primary goal being occupation, he, in one sense, might want to have a period of dalliance while he establishes himself in his occupation, gets a job, earns a living, particularly in the middle class, this might be the case. And so his orientation to sex would be much more as a source of pleasure, as a source of fun and enjoyment, but not necessarily as a relationship that one ought to try and promote love in, and one ought to try and get seek a marriage partner through. And this difference, then, I think is inevitable to maintain itself as long as you have this difference in the cultural emphasis. As long as you have the culture saying the female shouldn't have this as a primary goal, this secondary, the male's reversing the priority. If you need any evidence to see this, I think the best way of seeing it is to look at the situation today and see what would happen, or put it this way, what is an easy way for a male to break off a relationship with a girl, a sexual relationship, or an affectionate one together with sex? Easy way is for him to say to her, the only reason I've been taking you out is sexual. The only thing I like about you is your body. The female, in the vast majority of cases, would be offended by this, would say, what, you're not interested in my mind, in my personality, in my great sympathy, my sense of humor, my humanitarian values. She would be offended that all he was interested in was her body. But reverse the situation and have a girl say this to a boy, and have the girl say to the boy, the only reason I'm going out with you is physical. The only thing I like about you is your body. In this particular case, I think you might have a male who would be very proud about this, who would go back and probably brag to his friends that his body was that attractive, that he really has this girl wrapped around his finger physically. And herein, I think, lies the difference between the sexes, that the female and male orientation, the male being not oblivious of the affectionate factor. In fact, the male may prefer sex with affection, but he's perfectly willing to have it without affection. I'm talking now, of course, of very rough general averages, not of everyone. And the female, again speaking in this rough average way, is much less willing to have sex just for its own sake, and much more desirous of having it in the context of an affectionate, stable relationship, which is more in line with her goal of marriage. And I think that illustration then, which I think is quite realistic, illustrates the fact that there is no equality, no identity of sex interest between the male and the female. What there is a reduction in the differences in male and female sexuality, in that you have many more women today who are sexually awakened at earlier ages than you did, say, in the 19th century. you have many more men today who are awakened to the possibility of sex with affection and who aren't orthodox double standard types who will condemn any female that has intercourse with them. So that what you have is a feminization of the males, in that the males today are much tamer than their fathers or grandfathers. They visit prostitutes less, they prefer sex with affection more, and the females are more masculinized, if we can think of it that way, in that they're more willing to take sex on its own terms, and more willing to accept their own sexuality as something, as a good in itself, even though their emphasis is still on affectionate sexuality. Now, when did all this come about behaviorally? I think the 1920s, most of the evidence would indicate, is the key area, the key period of time, the key part of our history when the behavioral changes occurred. In the 1920s, the female rates of non-virginity virtually doubled. Since that time, the percentage of females non-virginal, the increase in that has been quite small, although I expect that in the next decade, in the 70s, that we'll probably see perhaps a 10-15% rise in non-virginity. Perhaps it's going on right now. Most of our studies are, of course, a few years old by the time they get into print. But from 1920 up until very recent years, the percentage of non-virgins in all studies that have been done has come out about 50%. About half the women in the 1920s, which are your grandmothers, grandmothers of the students in this audience, and about half the women today will enter marriage non-virginally. Now, there still could have been a tremendous difference in this 50-year span in other ways, in attitudes. The amount of guilt experienced today is probably much less. Perhaps the frequency of intercourse today is greater. Perhaps the number of partners a female has is greater. In all of these ways, I'm sure there has been a change. And there's no question that the public talk about sex is greater. Witness this colloquy wherein the discussion of sexuality is much more public than it ever would have been in the 1920s. So that there's no question that there have been changes in the last 50 years, but these changes have not been revolutionary. They have largely been in the area of attitudes rather than the area of behavior. And even the changes in the 1920s, which were very radical, were changes that were preceded from the Civil War to the First World War by a multitude of signs that could have been quite easily predicted given this awareness of the changes in our courtship system that was going on at that time. And I'll talk about this more in just a few moments. Now, the distinguishing characteristic of the present, if we move right up to this year, to 1969, the distinguishing characteristic is the legitimization of the choice of sexual standards. And this is something new to the 1960s, I think, although traces of it are building up during the last five decades. It really has come into its own in the 1960s. And what I mean by this is that the choice of a sexual standard is now considered as legitimate a choice, as much a right of a young person, as the choice of political party, Democrat or Republican, as the choice of religion, Protestant, Catholic, or Jew, or as the choice of anything else that we consider, although we may prefer one of the choices to the other, we consider all of them within the range of that we ought to tolerate. Now, I'm talking of young people legitimizing this choice. The parents have not. In our national sample, in my 1967 book, we found about 8 out of every 10 parents accepted abstinence for both the males and females, whereas only 4 out of every 10 of our 16 to 22-year-olds accepted that. So there's a radical difference here between parents and youngsters. But I'm talking now about young people themselves. And remember, our courtship system is autonomous. It allows the young person to choose his mate, to go out with whom he wants, pretty much, particularly as he gets older. to set his own pace on the dates. There's no chaperonage. There's no mother or father in the back seat. The system is set up to give the young person freedom, and the young people have exercised this freedom in the direction of saying it's a legitimate choice. The girl that's abstinent will typically accept the choice of the other girl down the hall to not be abstinent, and vice versa. There's a good deal of tolerance here, a good deal of individuality, and what this really boils down to is what gets the label of the new morality or situational ethics and so forth, which I think more concretely can simply be stated as the feeling on the part of the young people that there's more than one means to achieve the same goals. If your goals are a mature personality, a responsible person, a person with integrity, a person who knows how to give himself emotionally to someone else, a person who has developed the ability to be psychologically intimate with another person, if this is what you mean by your goals, and these are all, I think, very widely shared goals, then the young people today feel that some people can achieve these goals by being chaste, other people can achieve them much better by not being chaste. And I think this is the key difference in the 1960s, in that this really has brought the sexual choice into a legitimate realm. And I've personally found that this is really a key distinguishing characteristic of adults and young people. And a great many of the adults will simply say, no, you can't give young people this choice because any alternative besides chastity is not legitimate. And that kind of statement is made by a much larger group of adults than would be the case for the young person. Now, let's look at some findings of my own studies mainly, but my own study is an attempt to retest older hypotheses as well as a great many of my own newer hypotheses so that it really bears on general findings in the area of premarital sex. And this might do what I said I thought sociology could do, offer something for the young person today from the discipline of sociology that would help give him some insight into his own sexuality. For instance, on race differences, Negro-white or black-white, as it's currently popular to call it, differences. The popular view here is that the Negro sexuality comes out higher than the white sexuality, chiefly because Negroes are more likely to be lower class, and lower class people are higher on sexuality. Well, we found no support for this popular belief. We found, for example, that the Negro group, compared to a white group, both groups exactly the same number of years of education, exactly the same number of dollars of income of their fathers, exactly the same occupations of their fathers or of themselves, whether they're adults or young people, that the Negro group was still much higher on the acceptance of premarital sexuality as proper. Now, I think the reason for this is not hard to come by. The history of the Negro group involves a great deal more than the history of other lower class groups. It involves slavery, for example. It involves situations in which members of the same family, when sold into slavery, would be, in some cases, deliberately separated. Systems in which the Negro women were used more or less for breeding purposes or for sexual satisfaction of the white owners. And given this kind of background, one would be very surprised if the sexual attitudes today were not different in this group as compared to other groups. Now, as the Negro moves up in social class, for instance, our upper and middle class Negroes were much less acceptant of intercourse before marriage than were the lower class Negroes. Within the white group, this class difference did not show up Instead, what we found was that within the upper class group, say the upper third, I don't mean by this upper class the top 1 or 2%, I just mean dividing it into low, middle, and upper, bottom third, middle third, top third. Within that upper third, we found a very highly permissive element and a very low permissive element. We found the same thing in the middle third and the same thing in the lower third. Now, I think it was true a generation or more ago that the lower third of our socioeconomic scale would have greater acceptance of sexuality. I don't think it's true anymore. I don't think it's been true largely since the 1920s. I think this middle and upper third have been coming into their own in terms of acceptance of sexuality. And of course, college students like yourselves are exactly the individuals who have helped to, or some college students have helped to increase these rates for the middle and upper third. I think the reason for this is different than the reason for the lower class permissiveness. The lower class permissiveness, sexual permissiveness, was based on economic strain in general, in the case of the Negro, a history of slavery, on a fatalistic attitude, a feeling that, well, what's the use of playing it safe or waiting till you're married? Something's going to go wrong anyhow. It usually does in our neighborhood, in our kind of people. The feeling of being unable to control things, being a victim of circumstance, that was the basis of a kind of liberal sexual attitude. The new sexuality that particularly is prominent in the middle and upper third today is based on something quite different. These aren't poor people. They're not under economic strain. They're not fatalistic. They very often are activistic. It's based on the value of affection as being a key basis for having sexuality. It's based on contraceptive knowledge, which can prevent many of the consequences that people in this class feared because of the desire to avoid illegitimacy. It's based on a kind of rational evaluation of what are the pros and cons for my kind of person in my kind of situation, what would I get out of this relationship. And it's a quite different basis. And our evidence indicates this to be the reason why there is a equalization now within the white group among the different social classes as to the acceptance of premarital sexuality. The conditions under which it's accepted, the reasons for which it's accepted may vary by class, but the degree of acceptance is pretty much the same at the present time. And this, I think, is new to the 20th century, certainly. Now, other things that we found was that in terms of the effect of social forces on sexual standards, say the effect of religiosity, of going to church, of believing in dogma and so on, that these effects were not across the board true. For instance, our Negro group, if you divided them up into those that went to church a lot or didn't go to church at all, you found very little difference in acceptance of sexuality. Within the white group, for the males, you found some difference, but the real difference, the big difference, was found for the white females. If you divided them up into those that go to church a lot and those that go to church rarely, the differences were phenomenal. Something like 5 or 6% of the girls that go to church regularly accepting intercourse, 50 or 60% of the girls that rarely go to church accepting premarital intercourse. Now, I don't think going to church is the factor per se, but I think the style of life that it reflects is the factor. That a girl that would go to church every Sunday comes from a rather conservative background that would probably be conservative politically, economically, as well as religiously and sexually. And the whole aura of restraint would probably carry over and lead to this kind of finding. So this has some historical implications in that if it's the group with the lowest amount of accepted sexuality, that's the most easily altered. For instance, white females. Traditionally, they have the lowest acceptance of sex before marriage, and yet by removing a constraint like religiosity, you can increase their sexuality to a fantastic amount. If this is true, whereas with males, particularly Negro males, you do very little. If this is true, that social forces affect the groups at the lowest end of the sexual permissiveness continuum, then what this must mean historically is that you've got high permissive groups staying up there historically over a long period of time, low permissive groups like white females moving up toward high permissiveness and then in other periods of time down towards lower permissiveness and so on, being more easily alterable. Now that raises the question, well, why can't we picture the current scene as a temporary phenomenon? Just as, say, Elizabethan permissiveness was a temporary phenomenon. Or Victorian non-permissiveness, a temporary phenomenon. I think the answer is that in the case of all other high permissive movements, like the Elizabethan movement, or like going back to the Roman period, at one period of time, there was a high permissiveness there. I think all of those were partial permissiveness, lasting short periods of time and not having the full endorsement of the masses of people and not having the large middle class type societies. And let me just spell this out momentarily. What I mean is that the older movements were typically permissiveness postmarital. It was adulterous affairs. You read Congreve's Love for Love and you're talking about adultery there, not premarital intercourse, because marriages were arranged and these books were written primarily, and the evidence we have is primarily about upper class people who were in arranged marriages, and the sexuality that went on after marriage, not before. That's a major difference. Secondly, these were societies where 90% of the people were down at the bottom and a few percent at the top. So that what you were talking about was what changes occurred among that few percent at the top and got into the history books. What the 90% did at the bottom was something else and was typically this lower class type sexuality we've been talking about in earlier. Now, the situation then would indicate that today there's something radically different. We have a very large middle class population. We have the new sexuality premaritally, not postmaritally. We have it accepted by young people as a legitimate choice, and we've had it for a half century already in terms of actual half the women having premarital intercourse. So that the extent of time and the extent of people involved and the power of these people involved is quite different than in the past. And I think the reason that parents and legislators are concerned with problems like abortion, problems like premarital intercourse and illegitimacy today is that where these things have been going on for years, our illegitimacy rate in the middle of the 19th century was much higher than it is today, and the concern was much less. I think the concern is greater because their daughters and sons may be involved in this. The legislators' daughters and sons, the people in power's daughters and sons, so that now they've become concerned because it could involve them. Now, just one other finding here that might be of interest to you. We checked on guilt feelings to see whether or not that restricted sexuality. And what we found was that the guilt feelings were a very common experience. Now, I'm talking of females, although it's true for males too, everything I'm going to say, except to a lesser extent. But for the females, the typical situation was to start kissing at age around 12 on a date situation, not in a game situation. Start kissing at about 12, to have some psychological qualms about it, to feel that it's not exactly proper, to do it again and feel it's not quite as bad as the first time, and again until finally it's accepted, and then to move on into more intimate types of kissing, soul kissing, or more move on into petting, mammary or genital petting, and to feel quite guilty about that, to do it again and again until the guilt vanished and then move on. The only thing that distinguished one set of females from another was the speed with which they could move through these various stages and the age at which they got married, so that if a girl married at 18, she may not have gotten beyond kissing, whereas if she was one of our faster-moving females, by 16, we had groups of females who were accepting intercourse. So that there was a good deal of distinction. The common age at which change occurred was 18 and 19. And the key change that was occurring then was from kissing to petting. But for the faster moving females, 18 and 19 was the change from petting to coitus. But for almost all females, this was a key period of time. Now, 18 and 19 is the age that females leave high school and start college. Entrance into college is away from home, greater autonomy, dating older males, more experienced, perhaps more aggressive, becoming more aware of alternatives by being with a more cosmopolitan group of people. And so it makes sense that that would be a period of rapid change. But it's interesting that guilt does not restrict in the sense that people, as soon as they feel guilty, will stop the behavior. What people typically do is resolve the dissonance by repeating the behavior. Now, not everyone is able to do this, but over 90% of the young people in our sample reported ability to do this. And of course, what percentage one gets of feeling guilty depends on where your sample is. If your sample are people who have largely just overcome a feeling of guilt on, say, kissing or petting, then they're going to have very little guilt. If you get that same group of people a year later when they've entered into accepting intercourse, or practicing intercourse rather, and not yet accepting it and feeling guilty about it, then you again will get a great deal of guilt reported. So that guilt is a kind of cyclical, periodic factor. Now, one final finding of our study that's of interest: the generational change that people think occurred between the fathers and mothers of this generation and the youngsters of this generation was checked out in our sample by looking at first older and younger people. This was a national probability sample, the only national probability sample used for purposes of sex, sexual research, that is. We checked out to see whether older people would differ from younger people in terms of their acceptance of premarital intercourse, or actually that was just an easy point to cut the scale at. We had 13 points that we could have divided it at. I'm just simplifying it at cutting it at accepting or rejecting premarital intercourse. The difference that we found between older and younger people was rather small. It was there, but it was rather small, maybe on the order of 8 or 9 percentage points. Then we took people of the same age, say all 45-year-olds, and divided them up into single people, married people, no children, married people, young children, married people, teenage children. And we found some radical differences. Just between single 45-year-olds and married 45-year-olds was a difference of some 20 percentage points. And then between married 45-year-olds with no children and married 45-year-olds with teenage children was another 10% or so difference. What we found was that the acceptance of premarital intercourse went radically down within the same age group, so it can't be a generational difference. Went radically down if the person was single, or rather if he was married rather than single. Went down even further if they had children that were young, and went down to rock bottom if they had teenage children. Now, what this indicates is that the difference between parents and children is not a difference between generations, because these people that we were looking at are all the same age. But it is a difference between the role position they're in, and that if you put a person in the position of being responsible for their youngster's sexuality, you will lower their own acceptance and their own feeling of what is correct in terms of premarital sex. The same parents then, where 50% of the mothers of this generation were having intercourse before marriage, and the same percent seems to apply to their daughters. Still, the percent among mothers once they become mothers of teenage children is much less than it was when they were 20 years old themselves. So that the role position then seems to be a key factor. We check this out on siblings. You might be interested in the fact that older siblings are much more, on the order of some 20 percentage points, much more likely to reject premarital sex than are younger siblings. Younger siblings are much more permissive. And what is an older sibling but a kind of quasi-parent? Closer to adult values, more likely to be given responsibility for younger siblings, more likely to be indoctrinated into adult-type values. A whole host of studies indicate firstborns are more conservative than laterborns in a variety of areas. So that here is further verification of the idea that it's the role position that determines what you think about premarital sex, and that what you get is, from about age 10 to age 20, a radically increasing acceptance of sexuality among young people, and then after marriage, a slowly decreasing, until one's own children are 20, acceptance of premarital sexuality. And the 40-year-old parent with the 20-year-old daughter have met each other at opposite ends of their cycle, one at the low point, one at the high point. And I think this kind of conflict, while it may decrease in a generation such as this one, where talk is more open and discussion more free, is inevitable. It's sort of a union management type conflict. It's sort of built into the roles. All the risks, all the losses are on the parent's part in terms of he is responsible if the daughter gets pregnant, the son gets syphilis. All the benefits, the pleasure, the psychic intimacy, are on the young person's part in that they benefit from that. So that it's inevitable that people that are going to reap the rewards are going to be more acceptant, and people that are going to reap the penalties and not the rewards are going to be more rejected. Now, the overall theory that we arrived at, taking all these findings into account, was that the adult acceptance of sexuality is only one determinant of what young people accept. In other words, you take the adult institutions, how much is accepted by religion, how much is accepted by our political system, and so on, by our parents. That's only one determinant of what the young people will accept. The second determinant is the amount of autonomy given in our courtship system. In other words, how much freedom do the young people have? The greater the freedom, the greater the acceptance of premarital permissiveness of higher types. And the reasons are not hard to come by. The courtship system, it were a Martian sociologist to land on this planet and investigate our courtship system, he would clearly see, or I'm sure he would come to the conclusion, that it looks like people have set up our courtship system in order to promote premarital intercourse, because it's set up for about 10 years to put young people together without any chaperonage, to give the young people cars, particularly as they get a little older, to give them access to various drugs like alcohol and increasingly today marijuana, and to give them privacy in the home so that the living room or some comparable area is theirs when they bring their date home, and the parents will do everything to get out of the way, to not be seen, to not be meddling, introducing rather sensuous, rather provocative dances and dress and drinking, and customary an hour or two at the end of each date to be alone with each other. All of this, it seems to me, the Martian sociologist would say, well, it all seems structured to promote premarital sexuality. And in this sense, I think the surprising thing is how little of it there is, not how much there is. And I think the reason there is as little as there is of premarital sexuality of any kind is that the adult society has a very important influence. the parental values, not the direct values of I told you not to have intercourse, or it's wrong to have intercourse unless you're in love, or it's wrong to ever have intercourse if you're not married, not the direct statements, but the values of how important is freedom of choice, how important is responsibility, how important is autonomy, how important is it to be able to make up one's own mind, how important is physical pleasure, how important is psychic intimacy. The values that the parent inadvertently passes down on these areas will inevitably be predictive of the sexual standards of the young person. And in this sense, you have a control built in that whatever these values are, they will control the young person to the extent that is in line with these values, and to the extent that these values are pro-permissiveness in the way they're passed down, then you can expect the young person to be permissive. But you look at our marital system, where love is very important. You look at our courtship system, again, love is very important. You look at our marital system, where contraception is increasingly becoming important. You look at our courtship system, it also is utilizing contraception greater. And the reflection between the two, the control of the parental style of life on the courtship style of life, is rather obvious. And all the young people are presenting is a rather liberalized version of their parental values. They're by no means copulating at random. There is no runaway sexuality. There is no real sexual revolution. Now, what about the future? We've talked of past and present. What are the likely trends that people will head into? I think we can handle this very briefly by summing up and saying that I think the direction we're heading is toward a Scandinavian type of sexuality. And I say this again with the preface that this doesn't mean this is better than what we had before. It doesn't mean it's the best. It means this is the way we're heading. By this, I mean a kind of Scandinavian, I mean a kind of permissiveness with affection standard, where intercourse before marriage is accepted, but it is necessary that there be some affection required. I don't think this will ever get full acceptance. I don't think any one standard will get full acceptance of 200 and some million Americans, but I think this will get more acceptance than it has today. I think you'll still have abstinence as one of the major standards. I think you'll still have the double standard as one of the major standards. But I think permissiveness with affection will come more into its own as perhaps an equal choice or more than equal choice as opposed to these other standards. I think, as I've said before, there's little likelihood of any reversal of this trend. The likelihood is we'll continue to gradually increase our permissive attitudes and gradually increase our permissive behavior in the area of sex, although I don't see this getting to the degree where people copulate at random. I think in the case of the pill, in the case of contraception, what one could say is that 100 years ago, when the new contraceptive measures such as the male condom, the female diaphragm were coming on the scene, they probably did help promote intercourse premaritally in the middle and upper classes, because the middle and upper classes who wanted to have sex but didn't want illegitimacy now could have their sex without illegitimacy. And that probably did help promote the breakthrough that showed itself in the 1920s. But a new contraceptive measure like the pill or like the newer measures which will come into effect rather in the next few years will be much more easy to utilize than the pill. I don't think these will have any radical impact. It's one's values that determine how one utilizes a new gadget, a new invention. And there are a lot of reasons why someone might prefer other techniques to the pill. As long as there are efficient techniques available, a new efficient technique isn't going to make that much difference. I think religion will change, and it has been changing. Men like Harvey Cox, Bishop Pike are in the foreground of this, where you get more tolerance of alternatives, where you get more ministers saying it is a legitimate choice, that you can in good conscience choose to not be chaste. I think this will continue to be the case, if for no other reason that religion is afraid if they don't take this position, they'll lose the young person. And I think also, if for no other reason than the ministers are young people brought up in the same society, and they can't escape the values of other young people. I think sex education in the public schools will have an impact mainly in making the psychological choice less costly, more rational, more calm, less compulsive and anxious, rather than in choosing the direction of that choice toward more or less acceptance of sexuality. I think what sex education can do is clarify the nature of the choice rather than increase the number of virgins or the number of non-virgins. I think sociology has to offer some of the things I've said here today, insight for the young person into what is going on and why and what the trends are, what the choices are, what the likely consequences are. The ultimate choice is, of course, a matter of personal values that each individual has to make for himself. In conclusion, I think this generation, more than any other generation that I'm familiar with, I think has made its peace with its own sexuality and knows its own sexuality to an extent that we have never achieved before. And I think colloquy such as this are an indication of the intelligent, rational approaches to sexuality that the younger generation today are taking. Thank you.